very much, Thomas, for your kind words of introduction. Thank you also, Roger, for putting this together, for having us all here at the college. So my presentation will actually start with a beginning rather than with the conclusions. It will be about an analytic approach to integrating and evaluating climate change within economic models. And that's how I will start out, explaining that model. I will talk a little bit about the social cost of carbon, that is the optimal tax of carbon that Marty just discussed. I will be a little bit brief about uncertainty, even though it's in the title of the talk, but I want to skip towards some of the implications of this presentation for the Paris negotiation next month or the years to come, as Marty pointed out. So what are the main contributions to be expected from this presentation here? Well, I introduce a model which has an analytic solution and sort of very nicely decomposes the optimal carbon tax into the different contributions, but is supposed to have the same quantitative features or quantitative realism as some of the widely used integrated assessment models in policy advising, in particular the DICE model by Bill Nordhaus, which is probably the most widely used numeric model for integrated assessment. Another advantage of having such an analytic model is that if we want to integrate uncertainty, numeric approaches always run into what we call the curse of dimensionality under uncertainty. And if you have an analytic solution, you get rid of that curse of dimensionality. A little bit more in detail, what are some of the contributions? If you have this analytic solution, you see more detailed how different aspects of the discounting equation affect our optimal carbon tax and our welfare loss under certainty as well as under uncertainty. We can think quite deeply about the differences between having a stochastic natural system as opposed to having epistemological uncertainty, that is uncertainty in our minds. Like we don't understand the system completely, but over time we're actually going to learn about the system. And then perhaps the most interesting conclusion for Paris is that we understand better why the marginal damage curve in many of the integrated assessment models is pretty flat, which is something Marty just put in as an assumption into his talk, and I can give him a sort of profound model where it actually turns out to be flat. So that also implies that a cap might not be the most efficient thing to negotiate, and instead of promoting a tax, like Marty, I will actually promote a compromise, which I call a smart cap, and that's based on another paper, which is joint work with Larry Karp. So what is an integrated assessment model? An integrated assessment model is basically a joint representation of climate and the economy. And here, in particular, in the most integrated assessment models, we have a standard economic growth model, sort of lower right-hand side. In the case of my model, which I call Gauval, this is a standard Ramsey growth model over here. It's, you know, production, labor, investment, technology, all of that goes into production. But then what we add in order to talk about climate change is a set of energy production sectors. And these are clean sectors and dirty sectors. The dirty sectors use fossil fuels, which, while being burned, are generating CO2 emissions. The CO2 emissions go into the atmosphere. Some of the CO2 emissions from the atmosphere go into the biosphere or into the oceans, but some of them remain up there and potentially forever. They cause radiative forcing, which we usually call the greenhouse effect. That increases our atmospheric temperature. A little bit of that is cooled away by the oceans, at least for some time. But overall, we get an atmospheric temperature increase that has negative repercussions on our production and then on consumption and social welfare. And all of that, you know, happens repeatedly, period by period, interactingly over a long time horizon. In the case of this model, an infinite time horizon. I do not want to go into the details and the equations of the model, of course, in this short presentation, but I do want to distinguish it from the most closely related literature, which are two papers, one by Golosov, Hassler, Crusell, and Tsivinsky, and the other one by Gerlach and Liske, both of whom have analytic integrated assessment models. But what I contribute on the climate part of things is that I actually have a full climate change model in there. So it's the first analytic model to really have a realistic model of temperature dynamics, which is kind of an important aspect of climate change. And then that actually means sort of I have a carbon cycle, as most models have, but also the highly nonlinear radiative forcing equation in there capturing the greenhouse effect and a coupled system of ocean atmosphere temperature dynamics. And then on the economic side, what I add is a distinction between risk attitude and intertemporal consumption smoothing attitude, which a priori are two different things. These models by Golosov et al. And Gerlach and Liske assume that they are both the same, and more importantly, that they are both governed by a logarithmic utility function, which means we have an intertemporal elasticity of substitution of unity and a risk aversion coefficient of 1. This value is a very good approximation to the intertemporal elasticity of substitution, but a very bad approximation of risk aversion. Risk aversion is usually measured as something between 6 and 9 in the asset pricing literature. And so what my model does, it actually introduces a general coefficient of risk aversion, calibrates it to the literature, and keeps the intertemporal elasticity substitution at unity. And that allows for a better calibration of the model in terms of discount rates and risk premium. So the first result in the paper is a general theory result, which tells us about a class of integrated assessment models that we can solve analytically in closed form. So we can really write down with pen and pencil what the solution is. And here I want to say a little bit more about the calibration of the model. So first I pick a damage function which is calibrated towards the damage function of the DICE model that I mentioned earlier, one of the most widely used numeric models. In particular, I calibrate this parameter psi zero, which technically is the semi-elasticity of output to the exponential of the temperature increase. That's a fairly long and complicated thing, so let's just call it the damage parameter psi. And then I'll literally take the carbon cycle one by one from the DICE model, put it into my analytic model. The carbon cycle is characterized by the carbon transition matrix, phi here. Then I have to calibrate the temperature dynamics for the atmosphere and the ocean. For that, I use the MAGIC 6.0 model. That is a model that is extensively used in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's assessment reports. I find or calibrate the generalized heat transition matrix, which is sigma, and in particular one parameter that I call sigma force for forcing here, which captures the initial response of atmospheric temperature increase to the greenhouse effect and the radiative forcing. Finally, on the economic side, I just calibrate time preference, output, consumption rate in the usual way to the IMF's 2015 forecasts. Now, the only part of the calibration I want to show you at least one slide of, because that is the novel contribution to the analytic side of integrated assessment at least, is the one representing the temperature dynamics. And what you see as solid lines here is the output of this MAGIC 6.0 model used by the IPCC, which itself emulates the results of the big atmosphere-ocean general circulation models used by the scientists. I'm modeling the different IPCC scenarios, going from very strict reduction scenarios to business as usual scenarios up here. In dashed, I have the temperature dynamics of my analytic model called Galval. And we see that in this area where we're talking about optimal policies, the model is actually really good in capturing the temperature dynamics. If we go to the extreme business as usual scenarios, it's still pretty good, even though not that close. That it is pretty good, becomes more apparent perhaps if I put in the three models that have been used by the federal agency in the United States in order to come up with the social cost of carbon, the numeric models, DICE, Page, and Fund. All of them are quite a bit further off. So once I convince you that hopefully quantitatively the model is pretty decent, let's look at the analytic results. And what I have here is this closed form formula that I promised you for the optimal carbon tax, which in this model is the same as the social cost of carbon, SCC. And it is put together by sort of four different factors. One is this fraction over here that puts discounted future output in perspective to pre-industrial CO2 concentrations. This factor basically gives us the right units. It's dollars over ton of CO2. And then we have the damage factor, here the psi zero, semi-elasticity of net production to temperature increase. And together, these give us a first picture of what the social cost of carbon would be like if there wasn't any complicated temperature dynamics, but an emission unit would immediately affect our production. Then, sort of the next two factors represent the temperature dynamics, here the red terms, and the carbon dynamics, the green term. And these climate terms, they have these square brackets with indices 1, 1. What that means is I'm talking about the first element of the inverted matrix inside of these brackets, and that's pretty abstract. If you look at the paper, I have a nice explanation of these terms. You can actually expand them by their Neumann series, and you find that what, for example, this term here governing the carbon dynamics tells you is if you inject one unit of emissions into the atmosphere today, this gives you an infinite discounted sum of all of the carbon that remains in the atmosphere, either by just staying there or by cycling through the different reservoirs and getting back to the atmosphere in period T. More details on that in the paper. I want to turn towards the quantification of this formula here. And we do end up in the standard calibration of the model with a $57 per ton of carbon tax. That means a $16 per ton of CO2 carbon tax. This is $1 difference to the DICE model, the numeric model. And more interestingly, we can see what changes this value. It increases linearly in the output. That's a finding Golosov et al. Already pointed out. And it's proportional to the damage parameter. More interestingly, we have the climate terms that add to it. And so the temperature dynamics has two different factors coming in. The sigma forcing is essentially the initial delay from greenhouse gas injection and radiator forcing towards the initial warming of the atmosphere. That actually cuts down, because we're discounting the future, it cuts down the severity of the damages because they are further in the future. But then at the same time, we have some persistence in the climate system. There is an atmosphere-ocean temperature interaction. Once we warm the oceans, they will stay warm for a while, even if we get all of the CO2 out of the atmosphere immediately. So that actually increases the carbon tax by effect or by 40%. Altogether, this temperature dynamics cuts the tax by about 30%. And then we can look at the carbon dynamics, and the carbon dynamics is really what adds most to that carbon tax. That is a factor of 3.7, which is a consequence of the fact that carbon is very persistent. It doesn't simply decay. Carbon dioxide, or some of the carbon dioxide that we inject into the atmosphere, will leave into the biosphere, will leave into the oceans, but some of it will actually stay up there for good. And that's why the model is so sensitive also, as I will show you on the next slide, to discounting, and in particular to pure time preference. What this theory result tells you is that any carbon cycle that satisfies this mass conservation, that carbon doesn't simply decay, but only moves between different reservoirs in the ocean and the biosphere, will imply a factor 1/rho in the optimal carbon tax. And rho here is the pure rate of time preference, which is one component of the discount rate. So we all know that, you know, climate change evaluation is pretty sensitive to the discount rates, but very often we assume that it's the consumption discount rate that matters. Consumption discount rate tells us how much we value a future unit of consumption. But really what this result tells you is that it's highly sensitive to the pure rate of time preference only, which is the intrinsic devaluation of future generations that we inject into these models, and is hardly sensitive to growth discounting, which is because damages are usually assumed to be proportional, at least approximately proportional, to our output. Now, there has been a long debate about the discount rate, and there are good arguments why we might not want to stick with the standard calibration of the model that I used here initially, which gives me, in my case, with the IMF 2015 data, a pure rate of time preference of 1.75%. For example, for normative reasons, Stern has argued very strongly that we should use instead 0.1%, because we're talking about consequences to the next generations. But also on the descriptive side, there is quite a bit of evidence from the asset pricing and the macrofinance literature and the long-run risk models that the pure rate of time preference is actually pretty close to 0.1%. And these are purely descriptive models. And then sort of there are joint approaches to trying to disentangle individuals' time preference from generational time preference. And also they show us that we interpret what we observe in terms of market equilibria that derive from individuals that are planning for their own life cycles, then we'd rather end up with pure time preferences of 0.1% or in that neighborhood. If we plug that into our formula, we find a social cost of carbon of $660 per ton of carbon, or $180 per ton of CO2. And we can see, which is sort of the consequence of this proposition here, that most of this increase stems from that carbon cycle contribution and from the fact that carbon does not decay, but some of it actually stays up there for good. I want to be somewhat brief on the uncertainty summary here, but what I do in the paper is I, in particular, analyze the two most important climate change uncertainties. One is the one that we don't really know how the carbon is currently flowing between the different reservoirs. There is like a huge missing sink, more than the mass of, you know, all humans walking this planet currently is going somewhere every year, and we don't know where. It's called the missing sink. They launched recently a set of satellites trying to figure that out. And then the other major uncertainty is how our temperature will actually respond to CO2. That's called the climate sensitivity uncertainty. And what I find, if I compare these two uncertainty, we get by far the biggest welfare increase if we invest into a better understanding of the temperature response. The carbon flows where we have invested a lot are actually not that helpful. They are very interesting, but they don't increase welfare that much. And that's sort of in opposition to the deterministic part, where we see that the carbon dynamics is contributing the most. If we introduce uncertainty, what we add in for uncertainty, the temperature response becomes much more important. Then another interesting finding from that uncertainty part is that no matter what we analyze, these shocks in the natural system or this epistemological uncertainty in our heads, because we don't understand the system very well, we always end up with these equations or some sort of function of the distribution, uncertainty distribution's moment weighted by the according power of intertemporal risk aversion. So what matters here for our aversion to risk and our response to risk is not so much the standard measure in economics, which is the Arrow-Pratt risk aversion measure, but it is actually a measure of intertemporal risk aversion, which measures the difference between Arrow-Pratt risk aversion and our aversion to intertemporal consumption fluctuations, which also explains why these earlier models by Golosov et al. And Gerlach and Liske didn't find any really interesting uncertainty effects because they assumed them to be the same, which they are not. So we have to carefully take that intertemporal risk aversion into account when looking at climate change. And sort of a final result I want to briefly present. I think it's interesting. If you think about this idea that a lot of the climate change uncertainty is actually in our heads because we don't understand the climate system. It's not that the climate system is that stochastic, but we just don't understand it yet. But that means we also anticipate that we will be learning in the future. And our observations, as well as our better computer models, will bring us information about how the long-run future evolves. And we can think of these as learning shocks. And these learning shocks act very much like very persistent shocks to the climate system, like formally they're equivalent to highly persistent shocks. And because they are equivalent to highly persistent shocks, it makes these anticipated learning models most sensitive to pure time preference. So the Bayesian learning model is actually the model that will be most sensitive to the pure rate of time preference because of these learning shocks. Now, I want to switch over a little bit to its consequences for the negotiations here in Paris next month. And I want to point out that this formula I presented to you really has nowhere the levels of carbon or the level of temperature showing up. That implies we have a flat marginal damage curve over here. And what a flat marginal damage curve implies is if we go back to Marty's contribution, in particular his paper of 74, we probably want to keep the price of emissions fixed and not the quantities. Before we look into what that means for the negotiations in Paris, let me give you an intuition of why the marginal damage curve is flat. It's not simply because we're talking about stock effects here, but because there are three different ingredients. And the first one is the one that is quite frequently overlooked. And that is there is a strong falling marginal impact of CO2 on temperature. What that means is if we already have a very saturated atmosphere, there's lots of CO2 in the atmosphere, then most of the infrared radiation that is trying to leave our planet to go back into outer space, in that spectrum where CO2 is able to absorb, has already been absorbed. So adding yet another ton to that CO2 in the atmosphere doesn't do much, because currently most of the radiative forcing is emitting, or is leaving the planet in other spectra anyways. So we have this decreasing marginal impact of CO2 on temperature, and it's actually a logarithm, it's very concave. And that counters the increasing marginal damage of temperature on production, which is what most economists always have in the back of their mind. That gives us that, you know, a degree of temperature, if we already have a pretty high, like 2 or 3 degrees Celsius warming, is actually worse than the first degree of warming. And in addition, there is the decreasing marginal utility. And all of these three effects together here in this model completely set each other off, but in most numeric models, pretty much set each other off. And then the text or the curve might not be completely flat, but only very moderately sloped. So what this flat marginal benefit curve means for the negotiations here is that historically and currently we are negotiating quantity targets, but renegotiation periods, as we know from Kyoto to the post-Kyoto, are very, very long. And during that period of time, there is a lot of technological and macroeconomic uncertainty about the developing economies in particular. And that means it's actually not efficient to negotiate these quantity targets. It would be much more efficient to negotiate perhaps something like the text that Marty suggested. Now, in particular, if we look at a static world, his 74 papers, Prices versus Quantities, tells us that, yes, exactly, we should use a tax. If we think that this is an analytic model, so it's a bit extreme, many people give us slightly sloped marginal damage curves, at least, then we have to think a little more careful in a dynamic model. And in a dynamic model, it is no longer that the marginal damage curve is actually fixed, and only the marginal benefits from emissions are moving up and down, as in Marty's paper. But also the marginal damage curve responds to technology shocks because it influences the future emission trajectories. And then it turns out that just comparing the slope of marginal damages versus marginal benefits no longer tells us whether taxes or a cap is most efficient. This is work with my colleague Larry Karp. We're trying to quantify that within these models. But what we actually promote there is that we should just use what we call a smart cap. And that is what we say the optimal compromise between a tax and a cap. And the idea is that you are trading certificates, but the quantity denomination of these certificates is a function of the certificate price. So if I own one of these certificates and the price turns out really, really high, so emissions turn out very, very expensive, I'm allowed to emit a little bit more than 1 ton of CO2 with that certificate. If prices are very, very low, I will not be allowed to emit the full ton of CO2 owing that certificate. And in general, depending on how you pick that price response or quantity price response, you can get the optimal efficient rule for anything like a flat marginal benefit curve or a completely vertical marginal benefit curve. As importantly, if we think about the negotiations in Paris, I think it has actually some negotiation advantages to use such a more efficient policy tool. And I mean, first, it is a compromise between the advocates of a tax and the advocates of the cap. It uses existing markets that we have already built in terms of cap and trade systems, the institutions. And perhaps most importantly, it enables us to make a compromise in negotiations that turns out to be optimal. That is, we say, well, you know, let's agree that if technology turns out to make abatement very, very expensive, we can't bring the price down, then we do a little bit less. If, however, technology turns out to be very efficient, we get to really, really cheap emission reductions in the future, then we agree to do a little bit more. And that sort of, I think, enables the negotiations, and at the same time, it is more efficient. So let me conclude. What I presented was a die-style integrated assessment model with the same realism, but that solves for the optimal carbon tax in closed form. It basically decodes the different contributions to the social cost of carbon. It explains and quantifies the different uncertainty contributions. And in particular, we saw that under certainty, the carbon cycle is contributing most to the carbon tax. But if we looked at the welfare loss from uncertainty, then the temperature response uncertainty was the most important contribution. It remains that the discount rate perhaps is the most, definitely one of the most important ingredients into the actual value that we get out of the models for the optimal carbon tax. And I think we have to be very careful how to calibrate these models. And finally, the implications, I think, for the negotiations on the next COP in Paris or, you know, the years and decades to come, might be that we don't want to negotiate either a tax or a cap, but we want to be a little bit smarter in the sense of a smart cap and negotiate a quantity target that is a price of the, or a function of the abatement price. Thank you very much.